Live in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack wrenches from its tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, be you angels? And we said nay. We are but men. Rock.
Hey folks, this is Scotty Roberts. You're listening to the Intrepid Radio program with me and Dr. John Ward over there in Sweden. How you doing, John?
Fine, brother. It's a lovely 4 o'clock in the morning on a rainy, wet, cold Sweden day.
And, you know, and that's something people might not know, is that Sweden and Egypt are in the same time zone.
That's because President Sisi has decided to cancel the summertime savings again. So Sweden and Egypt are actually on the same time zone at this present moment. I don't know how they figure that one out, but yeah, there's no time difference. It's wonderful.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm fantastic. Spring has finally sprung here. You know, I just posted a picture to my Facebook a couple of days ago. On May 1st of 2 years ago, we had about a foot of snow. And this May 1st, we had almost 80 degrees. That's Minnesota, Wisconsin weather for you. Today was probably the hottest day we've had all year so far at the beginning of spring, well, mid-spring by now. And I dug out by hand a big area in the backyard for a garden. I dug about a dozen fence post holes and sawed things with a saw. Not a skill saw, not an electric saw, but a saw. I did it the manly way. My son said, why don't you just use the circular saw? I said, because a real man sometimes has to saw with a saw.
You don't have anybody to do that for you then. You have to do these manual things yourself.
Oh, yes, that's right. I'm not like you. Ahmed, I need some boards sawn. Have them here by two.
Did you wear gloves, protective material, or did you chap your
hands? I used my bare hands. And I was wearing a plaid shirt, so I feel rather lumberjacky today.
Oh, well done for you. Well,
I am a lumberjack, and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day. I cut down trees, I eat my lunch and go to the lavatory.
So tell me, what are your thoughts? I know that we had a little bit of a discussion before we came on it. We were going to talk about the new miniseries coming later this year on King Tut and so forth. But I do want to lead off with that segment that Rocky posted on his Facebook today with regards to the Seattle riots.
Yes.
What's happening in the States? What's going on over there?
Yeah, it's I want to look at that, and I want to say, what the hell is with you people? And I want to use harsher language than that. It says that there were people gathered in Seattle. This was on Friday night, last night, that hundreds joined earlier in peaceful May Day marches in Seattle and Yakima, Washington, in support of workers' rights and an end to police brutality and other causes. So there were a bunch of things that people were marching on.
Hang on a minute. Let me get this correct now. Police brutality, yet it's okay for someone to just basically walk up to an unarmed, plain-clothed police officer and shoot him in the head while he's in the car in New York. And that happened.
Well, and we've got a couple of cases of that. But this is what throws me. In protest to police violence, which isn't every cop out there, stories we've heard in the news represent a small decimal point fraction of all the police officers in the United States. When you think of all the major metropolitan areas to all going down through suburban areas, small towns, small cities, all the way down to your rural, you add up all those police and sheriff and then tell me the number of cases of brutality and per capita in these cities, it's going to be a vastly small minority. And where you have centers of urban dwelling where you've got 3 to 4 million people living in these cities and the cases are rather minute, it is not a rampant problem in the police department. It's that it's getting more news.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. As an American citizen, and I don't want to go down the route of conspiratorial, but do you think there's a hidden agenda behind the latest news items regarding police brutality? Do you think there's something behind this? Do you think that there's a group or groups or unidentified persons trying to bring more awareness, shall I say, upon such a minoritarized uprising?
Yes, in short, but that's it'd be a complicated answer, because I believe that those, for instance, just the other night, too, in Baltimore, when they announced, what day was it, Thursday, they announced the charging of the six police officers. Mm. And then there was a nonviolent protest. There was almost people celebrating, but there were people breaking curfew. And they were showing some of these people willfully breaking curfew and getting arrested. And some of these guys were not from the Baltimore area. These were your, and pardon me for sounding like an old man with the generation gap setting in, but these were your kind of greasy looking, and I'll put it this way, almost your Seattle grungy looking guys that were out there doing this. So they're coming in from other communities to do the protest, to get willfully arrested for breaking curfew and things like that. In Seattle last night, now I don't have any facts on my hand, in hand, but what happened in Seattle last night, it says that a peaceful demonstration against police brutality ends up with the mob throwing wrenches and rocks at police officers. One of them was injured because he was burned. Another one was injured with a broken wrist, and another one was injured with a
Do you think it's being sensationalized?
I think it's being picked up on. Here's what I think. It was like when remember the whole 99er and 1% thing when that first started a few years ago? It just seemed to me that everybody was piling on that to be here's what's at the root of some of this, I think. Let's get aside the racism question. Let's get aside the police brutality issue for a minute. I think some of this hails to needing something to believe in, whether it is idiotic. No, hear me out on this. Hear me out on this. I remember, okay. I think it was Kurt Cobain, I want to say, the rocker who's now dead, has been for almost 10 years, I guess, now. But there was a song I saw on MTV back when it was actually a music channel, which it doesn't even play music anymore, music TV, go figure. Now, all these networks have these titles, but none of them abide by what their titles are. History Channel wants to show shows about guys hunting alligators in the swamp, while MTV plays reality shows and not music. But there was a song, and it shows him sitting on a stool in a black studio, and there's a TV screen behind him that's flashing current events. And in essence, the song was this, and it was a very sincere song, I thought, and I can't think of the name of it, but they were talking about the singer was, and I think it was Kurt Cobain, was singing about not having anything solid to believe in anymore, that this, and I think this is where this generation is, because we have, I think our society in the last generation has really started to drift away from some of the core beliefs or standing on core beliefs on things in general. I'm not talking religion per se or morals per se. I'm talking in general. It's a society.
You're picking up on what we were discussing previously on Intrepid Radio, plus also what we were discussing with Rocky on the Situation Room, though, Scotty, where there is a lack of identification. People have lost certain markers individually on a personal basis. They don't feel that they belong. Religion has let them down. Their peers have let them down. The workplace, of course, has let them down. And they are missing that identification. Who do they belong to? What is their label? And right. That, I think, is part and parcel of the problem. I touched upon this yesterday. I don't know if you saw the news as well, that another, I think it was 1,700 migrants arrived at the shores of Italy yesterday. And just briefly, we were here with our neighbors last night here in Sweden in Globalstrup, and we were just discussing. I said, you know, take Halmstad, which is the small town that we live in here in Sweden. It's got a population of probably about 5 million moose and about 10 Swedes. But I said, nice. Imagine if 1,700 migrants just turned up.
Just turned up on the shore.
On the shore.
Getting off their boats.
Who would feed them? Who would clothe them? Where would they sleep? And then after the process of identification and clearance and et cetera, where do they disperse to? How are they dispersed? How are they kept track of? How are they helped? Who's helping them?
The government has to step in and give them a place to sleep, a place to eat.
Is this the government? Or is this the UN? Or is this the European Union? And, you know, you look at the figures. I mean, it's in the tens of thousands.
Well, I can tell you what. If I was the dictator of Sweden and a bunch of Muslim guys from Libya washed up on my shores, 1,700 of them, I don't think I would do much for them. I'd just say, sorry, guys.
Yeah, but this is a mixed bag, though, Scotty. I mean, regardless of religion, it's not just Muslims. It's Muslims, Christians, and atheists and non-believers.
And I didn't mean that to slam on Islam.
I know. But it does beg the question, and this is what I was touching upon in my little rant that I wrote yesterday, and that is the cultural indifference. And we're talking about identification of the youth of today. I believe what we're seeing right now is only the tip, it's the cusp of an iceberg, that in future generations, we are causing right now a major cultural identification problem, because people will no longer be able to identify with their countries or their roots. And I think this is going to be a major problem for Europe in the coming years.
Well, I think it's going to be a major problem in the United States as well. This is what I started saying with this. The generation coming up has lost a core of what to believe in. And so they have to. And I'm not saying it's a generalization I'm making, obviously. These guys that are in Seattle that are attacking police in order to protest police violence, what they perceive as police violence, do they really know anything? Do they know what's going on, or have they glommed onto a cause?
No, but what they do know is what they see on television, is what they've grown up with.
So, yes, it's sensationalized.
Well, I mentioned this to you last week on the sit room with Rocky, and that was that, you know, you look at some of the images that are coming through, and we all know that the media is biased, and they're able to turn a crowd of two people into a crowd of 100 people with clever angles and so forth.
Right. But
it does, when you look at it, it's like harking to something like The Walking Dead, or, you know, we were talking about Snake Eyes or whatever his name was, from Escape from New York and so forth. Those kind of Mad Max scenarios where people feel they want to vent their anger. They're so right. Pent up. They've got to release somehow. And so they release towards the police and the law enforcement.
This is what I don't understand, though, John. My anger is so pent up about the racism in this country and being held down by the man and all of this. So I think I'm going to go burn somebody's business down and steal their goods. I think I'm going to go smash a bunch of cars. I think I'm going to go throw objects at the police and try to do harm. How is that an expression of legitimate anger? That is unchecked rage.
Take that into consideration and put that into our own modern age, which is what is happening and what we are witnessing right now. But if you were to go back 200 years, these protests were still taking place.
Sure.
But there weren't cars to burn. There wasn't shop premises. They burnt the fields of corn. They ransacked.
Well, I tried to compare this to something like the Boston Tea Party, where a bunch of the Sons of Liberty got together in 1774 or 1775, or was it even earlier than that, where they got together and they dressed like Indians. Not really. They had their clothes and they put war paint on and feathers in their hair, and they went out in their waistcoats and their shirts and their pants and boots, and they stormed the English ships and they threw all the tea in the harbor to protest a tea tax. And they were making a statement. Now, is that different than a bunch of these, pardon me, heads full of mush going out into these public squares to demonstrate and to throw things at the police? Is this different? Do they feel that they we talked about the people stomping on the American flag the other day. Now, that's their constitutional First Amendment right to do that. And by the way, folks, just in case you wondered, there is no law against stepping on the flag, burning the flag, disgracing the flag. There's no law that you can be arrested for doing that. You can be arrested for burning something in public, but it didn't even have to be a flag. But all of these actions are being done to protest something. Do these people really want a seed change in government? Do they want a paradigm shift? I would dare say no, because I would almost be willing to bet my left leg that most of these people, if you quizzed them on civics, on government, on the Constitution, they aren't going to be able to answer the questions. Because
what kind of change are they looking for? Are you looking to disarm your police
looking to
force?
Get $15 an hour for working at McDonald's rather than $7.50 an hour. They're looking for, or even bring that up, just like $8.50, whatever the new proposed increase in minimum wage is. It's people who are working menial jobs want to have the kind of pay you get if you're working a career. Whereas you work at McDonald's, unless you're on a management a track and you want to get higher in management there, working for McDonald's for an hourly wage to make French fries and stuff paper bags is not skilled labor, and you should not be paid the same as skilled labor. And the argument comes across, well, those people need to make money to afford to live in their housing and so on. And I said, yeah, but it's not McDonald's responsibility to pay them skilled labor wage when they're doing part-time minimum wage types of non-skilled jobs. Should the guy that I bring over, the kid down the block to mow my lawn or rake my leaves, I pay him, you know, 10 to 15 bucks for mowing the lawn. Should I be paying him 75, what I would pay a lawn service? There's the big question. So this is the kind of things that these people are protesting. They are people who are ignorant of how business works. They're ignorant of how the country works. They're ignorant of the law. They are ignorant of the Constitution. All these people feel that. Now, John, I know you're a Brit, so you can hail back to the Magna Carta on this. But you understand bits and pieces of how our Constitution works, and where it says that each man is endowed with inalienable rights or unalienable rights, and the right to pursue life, liberty, or the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, what people forget about that is that the Constitution doesn't guarantee you happiness; it guarantees you the right to pursue it. And the Constitution and the government are not there to guarantee your success. They are there to guarantee that there is an atmosphere where you can engage in it. And you know what? If I sat on my white lily fat ass and didn't do any work, am I going to gain the American dream? No. It takes hard work.
Of course it does. But I think
like being a lumberjack for a day.
I think there are legitimate reasons why the protests are taking place. And just to switch gears.
Okay, give me your legitimate. Tell me what's legitimate about them.
No, I'm just going to switch gears a bit because there's always two sides to a coin.
I understand that.
We have witnessed and seen the reports of, police over the top, shall we say, excess strength and excess police brutality being used on victims, suspects, etc., etc., etc. So there is a legitimate cause for the protests. I do not for one minute condone any violence when it comes to protesting. All protests should be peaceful. But one has to ask the question, when does legitimacy get overturned and lost within the cause? Because I'm starting to ask the question, where does this end?
When mobs attack when mobs attack police, they lose their legitimacy.
Well, it's not just they lose the legitimacy, they lose the cause. And by losing the cause, they lose a voice. And by losing the voice, the whole aim of the entire protest is lost completely. But it seems to me that in this day and age, unless there is a violent clash or of that nature, then the voice is very muted and it doesn't actually get heard. One has to look at these clashes and start to ask the question, what is fueling them? What is the reason behind them? And what is the end game? What are they really wanting? And as you said, I mean, you used the word ignorant of all these different phrases that you were using just now. But does the youth of today really understand the way in which society works? And again, I go back to identification.
No, they don't. That's the problem.
What are they contributing? How do they, in their normal lives, contribute towards society?
Are some of these kids looking at this whole these scenarios, and are they saying, when I'm 75 and 80 years old, I can look back and say I was part of blank? What are they trying to achieve?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because today's news is tomorrow's chip paper, as we say in England. I think it's a flash in the pan, but it's disturbing at the same time because you can see that there's a ripple effect. And again, I call upon Europe, and I'm looking at the migrant problem, the exodus, as I've mentioned before, the exodus out of North Africa into Europe, and the problems. We've got a tinder cake, and it's about to explode. It really is, because you can't take in excess of 100,000 plus migrants into a small country like Italy that's on its knees economically and expect them to find jobs, housing, welfare. Right.
Can you think of another time in history, not even current history, can you think of another time in history that is comparable to what's going on in the world today?
No.
I've racked my mind on that one.
But then again, we can talk about what we've talked about many times before, and that is the way in which communication technology has really made the planet, the Earth, its population much smaller. As we just, you know, I wake up this morning at 3 a.m. in the morning here in Sweden, and I'm watching protests and violent clashes in Seattle. I'm riled by it. I have an emotive response to it. Yet I'm so far removed from it, it doesn't even affect me.
And the thing about that, John, is that you're looking at a story that happened in Baltimore. You're looking at a story that happened in New York. You're looking at a story that happened in Seattle, all major urban centers. But do you hear of this in Oklahoma City? Do you hear of it in Austin or Houston, Texas? Do you hear of it in Anchorage, Alaska? Do you hear of it in Los Angeles? So, yeah, a bit in Los Angeles. San Jose, California. Do you hear of it in Arkansas? Do you hear of it in Tennessee? Do you hear of it in Atlanta, Georgia? Do you hear of it in Minneapolis, Minnesota? Do you hear of it in you know, just the list would go on. And the problem with the perception out there is that the news media gives the perception, like we have said about Egypt in the past, is that the Western media will sensationalize something to death, and they will give the impression to people out there that everything is rotten and wrong, and because that's what you hear.
The impression is that this is America. America's on its knees. There's protests in the streets.
Right.
And, you know, again, America is so diverse and so disjointed. I don't think people actually realize how big America is, really. They see it on the news and they think, oh, my God, I can't go to America now. There's rioting in the streets and people are being shot at point blank range and so forth. And the police shoot people in the back. I'm not going there.
What's the size of the British Isles or of Great Britain itself? If you go from the English Channel north all the way up to the Orkneys, how many miles? 600?
Oh, yes, it's minuscule.
It's like from London to Edinburgh or to Loch Ness is roughly 400 miles.
No,
as the crow flies.
It'd be a bit more. Yeah, you know, as the crow flies, it's probably about 400 miles.
Yeah.
But it's a
so I know when I drove it, from London to Inverness, it was about 425 to 430 miles that we put on the car. So, okay. Well, now, if you look at that and you say Minnesota, the northernmost central state in the United States, for those of you listening who don't know the geography of the United States, the state of Minnesota alone, and there's like four or five more states till you get down to the Mexican border in Texas. Until you get all the way down to the southern border, the Gulf of Mexico, state of Minnesota is about, I want to say, if I drove 450 miles north of here, I wouldn't be in Canada yet. Just about. But it takes about 7 hours to drive from here to Canada. And in that same, and I think it's roughly, maybe it's roughly 500 to 600 miles, okay, to the northern border. But that, putting that in perspective, you could almost fit the British Isles into Minnesota and Wisconsin, and that's two of 50 states, and not even the biggest ones.
I think media has created, as we've said many times before, is created a misnomer. People look at the news, yes, and they think, as you say, you know, they see clashes on the street in America, and they think, oh my God, it's the whole of America. They see clashes in Tahrir Square in Egypt, and they think, oh my God, it's the whole of Egypt. It's a problem that we have to deal with in our own generation. But it's down to education. It's down to making sure that our children are aware geographically of their own environment, where they are and where they stand in the world, how big the world is, how diverse it is.
Yes.
It is education. And we've just got to make sure that we bring up our children correctly and in a manner in which we would be proud of. I would not be proud if one of my children took to the streets in protest in a violent clash. I would be proud of them if they took to the street in a protest, peaceful protest, for whatever reason, which they stand for and they believe in. But to turn it into a violent clash, there is no need for that in this day and age. And
do you remember the video that came out? Remember the video that came out from Baltimore last week of the mother that was slapping up her young son who was going to be part of the protest? And she was hailed as one of the best moms in America. And now the criticism of her is coming out. And you know what they're criticizing her on?
Slapping.
Using abusive language and violent behavior. Okay. And so she can't possibly be a good mom. So, you know, that's how they get you in where political correctness reigns freely, which is a cancer, I believe, to our society, where political correctness reigns, you are going to have this kind of thing continue to happen over and over again. And this is why I know a lot of people trying to run for president for the next election are running against the current administration's agenda, saying we need to change things away from the direction they're going. And that's what they're all running on. So right now, the millennials, as they call them, really the amalgam of the Generation X to a certain extent, not as much the generation whatever came after that, then the new millennials, they kind of comprise what they call the millennials nowadays. And I think that's mostly in United States culture. But these millennials are the ones that have grown up over the last 20 years especially, and they've entered into a world where political correctness is the name of the game. There are kids I talk to nowadays in their 20s that have no idea what I'm talking about when I hail back to the way things were done even when I was a kid. And in the 60s and in the late 60s and all through the 70s, and they can't believe that we did things the way we did back. Oh, they can't believe that they allowed people to smoke in an office building and things like that. I mean, that's minutia there, but this is how things have changed. And so I think the solution to this, I know, I'm not even going to go there. I'm not even going to go to solutions. I want to spray about the problem right now. And the problem is that kids need to be educated.
There's no solution without identifying the problems. And I don't think correctly identified the problems. I think we're very quick, especially in our generation, Scotty, I think it's very quick for us to jump and label these people.
I am very good at finding it. I think I can identify it. I really do. And I don't mean to sound cocky with that in any way or arrogant, but I believe the problem is firmly rooted in one thing, and it is lack of education. And I don't mean lack of going to school, lack of being schooled by the government, whatever it might be. It's lack of knowing anything about anything. Education goes a lot further than your books. It goes a lot further than arithmetic and reading and writing. Education has to do with understanding how the world works, understanding how your government works. And when the schools are dead set on...
Are we to blame?
Yeah. Our society is to blame.
Sometimes we've got to look in the mirror and say, okay, guys, it's about time we put our hands in the air and said we're to blame, because it's not our governments, it's not our police, it's not our law enforcement,
right.
It's not political agenda in Iraq or Afghanistan that's caused this problem. It's not the cultural political correctness team or the liberals. It's us. We haven't.
Right.
And you said that from time to time about, you know, who's going to save me and everybody's gone and so forth, that quote that you used from the Second World War. I think sometimes we've got to stand up and be accounted for.
I agree with you. And folks, you're listening to Dr. John Ward and me, Scotty Roberts, here on the Intrepid Radio program, right here on the IPBN-FM Alternative Talk Network. We'll be back right after this break.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there. We have 15 seats available and they are already starting to book up. So go to exodusreality.com and get your place reserved today. That's exodusreality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about that special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. And what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57 is not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but it drinks smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Fast Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
When we make Beyond Natural dry dog and cat foods, we start with real meat as the first ingredient. We leave out corn, wheat, and soy. And we own where our dry food is made. 100%. Can other brands say all that? For nutrition you can trust and your pet will enjoy. Does your food go beyond? Learn more at PurinaBeyond.com.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to scottallenroberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com to take a look at his online portfolio of work or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you, year after year, with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
John, who was your boyhood crush?
Oh, that would have to be Mandy.
Mandy.
Yes, I can't remember her surname, but it was Mandy. She was a little girl, but I was a little boy. Long blonde hair, long flowy, flowery kind of dress, very chintzy, if I remember rightly. And she always wore a white cardigan, and her hair was always ruffled and kind of, it wasn't braided, it was a kind of like a, it was a bit strawy, a bit of a mess.
And I approached her, and she said to me, "Go away, you ugly, dirty little boy from near the Welsh border."
No.
Well, the reason I bring that up, my first childhood crush, now I'm talking like on TV, was, do you remember the original Star Trek? You remember Yeoman Rand, the blonde yeoman to Captain Kirk. You remember her?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Gorgeous, like she just passed away.
No.
85 years old. Rest in peace, Grace Lee Whitney.
Well, if you're talking about TV crushes, my first TV crush was Felicity Kendall.
Who is Felicity Kendall?
We're talking
Channel 4 in Great Britain. Which augments Channel 7.
We're actually talking about the BBC. It was YouTube it, The Good Life, and look at Felicity Kendall. She's a very British version, I suppose, of Jennifer Aniston back in the 60s and 70s. And she had most amazing. Lovely thoughts.
Well, anyway. speaking of having the most amazing, we have a great guest on tonight. And she actually agreed to come on at the last minute for me because I noticed our calendar for the show, and we have several guests lined up except for tonight. And so I just gave her a call, and it's not that you and I can't handle ourselves for 2 hours talking. I mean, perish the thought. But
listen to you going on about your Bible study and everything else.
Have I mentioned the Bible once, Mr. Minimalist, Satanist, Occultist, Nazi?
Actually, no, you haven't. Well done.
Thank you.
Please continue. Introduce our amazing, fantastic
guest. I will introduce our amazing, fantastic guest. This is somebody who is a friend of both you and I, a wonderful friend of both of us. I've known Cassidy for a number of years. This is Cassidy Nicholas. Who used to be Cassidy O'Connor, for those of you who might know her from her pre-marriage name. She goes by Kat. I met Kat for the first time face-to-face, had to be in 2009, I want to say. But I'm not positive of that. It was up in Upper New York. I was up there with some members of Ghost Hunters to one of the asylums up there. Rolling Hills Asylum. ghost hunting investigation. Yes. Yes, where I was straitjacketed for a while. She came and brought me food. So we got to know each other. She has written for Intrepid Magazine. She's an author and a writer. She is somebody who is, well, here, let's just kind of run down it a little bit. She's been working with MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. As an archivist, she's responsible for organizing a new historic view of nearly 70,000 cases within the database. And she also works with their magazine. She was the co-host of Thresholds Radio and then Paraliminal Radio. She has several books that have been published. She was spotlighted in TASS Para Magazine, National UFO Examiner, The Buffalo News, and many other publications. She has some documentary work out there. She's been part of the Paradigm Symposium for the last 3 years, save for one, I think it was. She is now one of the talking heads, if you will, or a commentator, I guess is the polite way to put it, on season two of Hangar One on the History Channel. We have with us tonight, Kat Cassidy Nicholas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
It's our fantastic.
Do you know where I first met Cassidy?
Where, John?
What? In a bar. It wasn't a strip bar, but it was a bar.
It's the Casbah.
It was a bar, but we were drinking coffee.
And I was eating bacon in a bagel.
You were
breakfast.
You hadn't had it in a while.
I was actually quite intimidated by you. I found you intimidating.
Well, really? I'm 5'10". What do you expect?
I was very intimate. Well, I was sat there. I was jet lagged. I had Micah Hanks, who was mouth of the South as usual. I had Caleb Hanks. I mean, oh my God, put those two together. That's an asylum. That's an asylum all wrapped up in one. And there was Cassidy. And yes, we were talking about dowsing, I believe.
I think we were.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a child who aspired to be an Egyptologist, when I first met you, I was taken back. I thought, oh my gosh, he just flew in from Egypt. Holy smokes. This is the coolest guy ever. And now I get to know you, and I just giggle about that.
Now, speaking of Egyptology, it makes me think immediately of archaeology. And you have done some work. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought you were working towards an archaeological degree, and you've either left off of that, but you had done some work, some research work up in New York State. Tell people a little bit about your background, let's get into the way background of Kat and Nicholas, and tell us a bit about that.
Well, I wanted to be an archaeologist my entire life. I wanted to be an Egyptologist. It was what I wanted to do with my life. I ended up going to school for criminal psychology and falling back after my schooling, you know, after a few years, and starting a family and doing all the grown-up things that people do. And I'm just going to go back now to finish a psychology degree, probably next year, because I feel that I can do a lot more with my life with it. But as for archaeology as a hobby, as something that I was very interested in, ever since I was little, I was digging rocks out of my backyard. My parents had the no strange bones in the house rule. Huh. You know, so I could have done amazing things. I've been part of and present for different things in my area in Midwestern Pennsylvania, a lot of really, really amazing sites that I was lucky enough to be standing there for. And where we live here up in Western New York, we have constant digs happening up here. We have very old area and a lot of Native American digs, a lot of history. So I'm constantly finding different things that are going on.
Are you comfortable talking about, without naming the site or the location, are you comfortable talking about some of the really odd stuff that you've run into up there? You told me some stories over a series of months about things that had happened to you at a certain site and things that you were seeing and things that you were engaged in. Can you talk about that at all?
I could touch on it, absolutely.
If you're comfortable with that.
Absolutely. Because I think that it helps to, as you grow into yourself and as you learn and as you research, because you're always learning, I think that over the years, my mindset has changed with many things. And I'm absolutely comfortable in talking about it because who I was 10 years ago and who I am today are two completely different people.
And the reason I ask that, I put it that way, is because I know John has run into lots of very interesting things. Let's put it into that category, over in Egypt. And I have run into my interesting things over in Egypt with John. So this whole digging into history, historical research, when you get your hands dirty with it and you get down in the dirt and you're looking for things, you can sometimes, and John, you can pitch in on this too, you sometimes run into stuff you don't expect.
True.
Now, you told me...
We do about that kind of stuff.
Yes, not a lot. The Ministry of Antiquities would
exactly
would not be very happy, as Rocky would say.
Exactly.
So, yes, you had some experiences with one of these sites.
There was two, actually. There were two sites that were really interesting. And before I really dug my heels into MUFON and ufology and started really directing my focus into that area, I did a lot of work in the paranormal for many years. And there are many times where people would call and say, my house is haunted, or we're seeing odd things, or, you know, the run of the mill. And I started to learn that when something is happening, whether it is happening or not, whether it be, you know, something that can be identifiable, whether it isn't, if you go back far enough, you can always almost find a reason for it. And many of the cases that I've worked, two in particular, brought me back to Native American origins and earlier. And it took many years of research. It was a really interesting path for me to take. I'm glad that I did. And some of the darkest things that I've ever come in contact with, whatever they may be, and I do not have an opinion on what they are, it stems back to history. And I have uncovered internment camps. I have uncovered mass graves, just different things in areas that seem to cause, you know, issues in today's world, whatever they may be.
What kind of internment camps?
A Native American internment camp in our darker areas of history in the United States. And it seems that even today, you know, there are still things that go on. I won't get far into it.
When you say that there are things that still go on without crossing that line into saying, I want to talk common sense and I want to talk really scientific, but there are things that happen that fall outside that realm. Give us a little taste.
And, you know, no matter how much you put things into different categories and you try to scheme things into one or the other, it always comes out to it is outside the box. And I have a firm understanding of this. You know, when given a location and there's problems, a lot of people don't take the time to go through history. This is going through archives. This is going through families. These, you know, time and time again, going through and picking through, you know, archives, property records, things like that. There's a location here that's 3 miles from here that I have probably spent hundreds of hours in archives flipping through, you know, books and you can seem to almost find patterns. You can seem to find things from money loss to suicides to, you know, to death and destruction of some sort or another. To continue that path, and you have to continue to go back farther and continue to go back farther. And a lot of people don't have the patience or the time to do it, or the will to do it. You know, you can trace things back. You can watch the lives of people that were there, and you can almost pinpoint when something happens. Down to, I'd say, about 50 years, depending on how far you go back.
And see, that's crazy to me. That history exists there, and all you have to really do is look for it. You've got to go dig for it. Sometimes you're going to run into dead ends. I agree with that. But now, modern history, of course, and by modern, I mean the last few hundred years, a little easier to dig for things and say what John does when you're digging back 3,000, 4,000 years.
Absolutely.
I'm sure the facts get a little sketchier the further back you get. Even with some of the things that you've investigated over the years, you have newspaper clippings that you can hail to, even that are 100 years old. You
Absolutely.
Have things like that, library records, things like that.
Library records, mapping systems, anything you can imagine.
Usually have you run into anything much more ancient than that in the Americas here?
Well, in my area, yes. I'm lucky enough to live in an area that is widely known, whether people agree with it or not, that we had giant humans here. It follows all the way through my area, all the way down almost into Ohio. It's common knowledge. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen the picture of me standing next to two very large statues. That's in one of our museums. It's well known. In our area, they have uncovered several different areas that were, things are bigger, and they have to go by old articles and things like that, because due to the makeup of our soil and the weather that we have here on the East Coast, things don't last long. When they do last, if you bring them out into the air, they seem to deteriorate. So we have to go on basically paper runs to figure out, you know, what was here, go look through if there's any photographs of things that were unearthed. We are an area here that is very known for having giants, honest to God. They were here, and we actually have mounds in our area that if you touch them, you walk on them, or you try to any kind of digging or anything, you will be, it is a federal offense.
Now, what makes those sites a federal offense? Does that tie into the whole, I don't buy the conspiracy theory of the covering up of giants, but do you think that that is something that ties into, is there some kind of conspiracy there in your opinion?
I don't know if there's a conspiracy or not. I just think that the local people of these areas, these town governments, and even above,
really?
They know that these things will be destroyed if they are unearthed.
Okay.
Well, it should be a federal offense if you've got people going around willy-nilly digging up.
Well, sure.
Absolutely.
Digging their way through historical mounds. It should be a federal offense.
And the funniest thing is we're not known for, you have Ohio, you have all these wonderful places that have these beautiful sites. We're not really known for it, other than Enchanted Mountains out here and things like that, and a lot of Native American folklore. I'm talking, as I sit here as the crow flies, 4 miles one way, we have one, 5 miles the other way. They've unearthed things all over our area, and it's really genuine and unique here. I don't think there's a conspiracy to it. I think that they just don't want anybody touching them. I mean, there's a famous story of the farmer down the road here that would shoot at people. he would shoot the gun in the direction if you walked onto his pastures. So,
but when you talk of giants, Cassidy, yes. Are you talking genetics?
Yeah.
Are you talking genetics, generational genetics and so forth, or are you talking something else when you talk about giants?
As the story goes here, when they crossed the Mississippi, we had the more barbaric Indians that came over, and that these giants were here, and they were very advanced. I'm not talking Atlantis here, but I'm talking, they were copper, they were mining, they were doing a lot of things that were above their time. And the story goes, as they came over to the east, they didn't get along with the other natives that were in this continent at the time. There was a lot less of them. Nobody really knows. All we know is they were here. Nobody really knows what happened. But we know that things have been unearthed here, and they go from anywhere from 7 to 10 feet tall.
Wow.
Nobody knows because the soil content we have here is very acidic, and we're very damp, we're very cold, we have the crazy weather changes, which is okay with me because we don't have hurricanes, we don't have any of the crazy natural disasters that the rest of the world has, we just have really harsh weather, and it changes. So nobody really knows, but we do have a lot of ancient history here. So,
and that's fascinating because in the United States you don't think about that because our minds and our society go back about as far as the founding, which was, well, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, about 235 years, something like that. There's been civilization here. European civilization started a couple of hundred years before that. And mm-hmm. prior to that, you had the explorers who were discovering what? Native peoples that have been here for a long time. And
absolutely.
You look at a place like the Serpent Mounds, which is on this chain, the string that you're talking about running from New York down through the mm-hmm. Midwest and in the Ohio's. My dad lives about 20 miles from the Serpent Mounds in Ohio. I've never been there, but I plan to go visit him and I want to go visit that. But that is part of this apparatus was the word that came to mind. That's not what I'm thinking of. It's part of that culture that built
absolutely.
These things.
Oh, I think there was a lot going on here, and I think it's a shame that they refrain from teaching this to our youth. When you were in school, and John, I'm not speaking of you, I'm speaking of Scotty, how far back did they go? They talked about Native Americans were here.
Right.
That's it. And then they say Christopher Columbus discovered America, which is a crock, and this is what they teach our youth.
But, of course, that's what I was taught. John, you probably didn't hear a whole lot about Columbus because it wasn't British history. But over here, you know, we heard about that. And it wasn't until really I was in my 20s and my 30s that we really started hearing, and we're talking the 80s to the 90s, where really the Native American movement was really bringing out the fact that, and it was really the first time I had considered it and really thought about it, even though it was right there in front of your face,
right,
because they say when Columbus got here, there were Native tribes here. Well, okay, but still, Columbus discovered America. Okay, cool. And, you know, you go with that because that's what you're taught and you don't think about it. This is kind of what John and I were talking about in the first segment, is that I think a lot of the millennials and the kids nowadays, they don't learn that. They learn things, but they don't learn things. They don't know things They know things only from a certain angle.
We haven't changed it, though. And you know, we talk about, and we've talked about this before, about Native Americans, when we had Fast Horse on for a few generations now. This has been the main topic of debate. You know, it's not taught. You're taught about Christopher Columbus finding America. That's it. Oh, there were Native Americans. Yes, there were a bunch of Indians, and they lived in teepees, and we drove them out. That's about as much as you get. But we have not changed the system. No. And that harks to our original conversation before Cassidy came on. You know, we have to affect change. If we want to see change, we have to affect it. And if we want the educational system to change and adopt new standards and look at more within history of America, its prehistory, beyond that of Native Americans as well, then we have to affect that change. It's about time people like ourselves, the silent majority, actually started to have a voice in that respect. And I get quite passionate when it's about history and so forth. And for all of our rantings and so forth, sometimes sitting on the fence and just shouting from the fence line doesn't affect change. But we must affect change ourselves.
I would agree.
See, and I couldn't agree with you more. But see, I was lucky enough, I grew up in the center of the Iroquois Nation here. And so history to people in my area is more than that is taught in schools, and there's a more of a respect there for history, because it's very important in New York where I live. So thank God that I was raised in an area that taught you more than they did in class. I've come to learn, and the older I get, the more appreciation I have for different folklore and legends and ways of life that other people have, because it's very important. It's history. It's their history.
Yes.
And it needs to be respected. You know what I mean?
I do. Kat, we're going to talk to you a little bit more about this, and we're going to bring up some other things that you do. We want to talk about TV. We want to talk about what you do with MUFON and UFOs. You work for an organization that is really focused on what many people think is the woo factor out there. And so we're going to talk about that when we come back. Folks, you're listening to Kat or Cassidy. I always want to say O'Connor. I'm sorry. That is so stuck in my head. And so I always pause there. Kat Nicholas. That's her married name, folks. Yes, guys. Back down. Back down, she's taken. So, Kat Nicholas, you're listening to with John Ward and me here on the Intrepid Radio program, right here on IPBN-FM.com. Alternative Talk. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there. We have 15 seats available and they are already starting to book up. So go to exodusreality.com and get your place reserved today. That's exodusreality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about this special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. And what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57's not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but it drinks smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Bass Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best f***ing awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to scottallenroberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
Simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
And you know what?
We're back.
That's not what I was going to say.
I know, but I said it then.
You certainly did. Here's something that's very interesting with all the work that Cassidy, that you're doing with. And by the way, folks, if you're just joining us, Scotty Roberts, John Ward, the Intrepid Radio program with our guest, Kat. I almost said O'Connor again. See, it is so ingrained in my head. So Kat Nicholas.
Do you have a problem retaining information?
I do.
Scotty, I've been married for 5 years.
I know this. It's a mental block. Cassidy Nicholas.
People have said to us before that we're like this armchair duo in front of an open fire and so forth. We win back chairs. All of a sudden, I just saw us as those two Muppets, you know, the old men up in the box.
Hey! Yeah. When's the show today?
I don't know. Has it started yet?
I see the next one.
I don't know why.
It's your clean-shaven face juxtaposed with my horns on my mustache.
The handlebars.
Yeah, they're not. It's not really a mustache. It's just slightly turned up at the corners.
Completely turned up. Oh, you could hang
heavens. So, Cassidy, what I was going to say, and I don't even remember how I started this, but the very interesting thing is that the work that you're involved with, you're archivist for 70,000 cases of what you're going through with MUFON. As we said on the way out, when we start talking about some of the woo factor that's involved in some of the things that you do, archaeology, we didn't even get into overtly talking about the paranormal, although we talk about metaphysics and paranormal things. I hate the word paranormal as it relates to the community that has become known as the paranormal and the bad name they give that kind of research and that kind of that body of activity. While you work for an organization that works to bring to the surface the facts and to qualify some of the stories that are out there when it comes to UFOs, does MUFON deal with alien cases like the alien abduction thing, or do they stick strictly more to the dealing with sightings?
MUFON is a very broad organization, and the reason that I love it so much, and I'm going to bring something up to you. Do you remember, Scotty, the first Paradigm Symposium?
Yes.
And the hotel staff was giggling, and they said, my gosh, when we heard what this was going to be, we thought there were going to be people running around with green suits on.
Yes.
And tinfoil hats, and they were amazed to see the level of integrity, education, and intelligence of the people that were at the conference, not only the attendees, but the speakers. They were very taken back by how much education and was actually there. I think that the whole woo factor, I think that, you know, alien abduction and all these things that, you know, have this tint to them as being this woo factor and this and that. What MUFON is that it's an organization, and the cases that we have are all witness submissions. All of them. They are all from anybody in the world that has either seen something and experienced something or is something they want to show. This goes to anything from seeing something after they took a photo to having a possible abduction. These people go through things. MUFON, as an organization, does their best. They have a very amazing core set of people. And MUFON has directors who run the entire state. They have chief field investigators. They have field investigators. They have amazing people. We have a scientific review board that is impeccable. It's wonderful. I'm very proud to be part of it. And the woo factor that is put out there is really a huge misconception of who we are. Because with the paranormal and what I did for so many years, as you say, I noticed that I wasn't getting enough out of it. I wasn't engaged enough. When I dove back into ufology, I was in MUFON for a couple years. I left it. I focused on other studies. And then I went back to MUFON. The integrity of people inside that organization, these are intelligent individuals. These are engineers. These are astrophysicists. These are amazing people that are part of this organization. There's a lot of education. And what they do is if somebody puts in a submission, they assign them to different field investigators that are all over the world. These investigators go and they investigate it to the best of their ability. We have cases stemming back from 1888 that somebody says, my grandmother speaks of this happening. You know, what do you think? They also go through, they trend, they see, having such a database as we do, if we have five reports in one day of, you know, five different people seeing the exact same thing, now that's something that we need to look into. There's a lot of things that are known as IFOs in that 70,000 cases. Most of them are identified objects. They are planes. They are stars. They are planets. They are another big thing, especially I know in the state of Florida, are drones. You know, the little drones that people have, or
yes,
the bigger
yes.
ones. So a lot of people are seeing these things. They're not used to seeing them on the horizon. They're taking video and film of them and saying, what are these? The people in the organization will come back and they'll investigate it and give them their best. So as for 70,000 cases, what I am doing is, what MUFON is trying to do and what I am doing to help them is to show people the cases that we have that are ruled as unknowns. They are closed as unknowns, which means we could not figure out what it was. Not saying, oh my gosh, that's an alien. We're saying we don't know. Displaying those cases and bringing them forth to the public and saying, look, these are a lot of cases to bring forward. And there's a lot of things that are on the odder side and a lot of things that are quite amazing There's FIs that have never seen anything, that strive every day. The fact is these are all witness submissions. This isn't an organization that's just going, okay, we're going to do this. These are all pouring in from all over the world daily. And I'm talking 30 to 100 cases a day come into our system.
Wow. And this is how you have a database that's in the tens of thousands like that.
Absolutely. We have other paper files that have been selflessly, you know, digitized by some of our higher members or our more senior members. These are things going back to the 60s. This is amazing. I mean, just having a database of this information, being able to look
that's,
at it. That's
living history. That's
it
living
is.
History. That's it quite is. Wonderful, actually. Regardless of the woo factor or the ufological side of things, that is actually testimonies of history in the making, and that's wonderful to have such a database.
Absolutely. And
what's the most amazing case you've come across so far, Cassidy? If you were to pick one at random, what would be the one that would stand out to you?
Of all time, I'd have to say the Rendlesham incident in December of 1980. That, to me, was a very close encounter that was well documented. The individuals that have studied this, that have brought it forward, that have experienced this, these were all wonderful, educated individuals. And I think it says a lot. And I think it's still a case of high interest to me. It's one of the first ones I ever really looked into. I think that's kind of particular with me. But they're all, in their own way, amazing. Because if you look at the psychology behind these people, everybody, I mean, there is not a demographic, all over the map. And I think that goes to show as well. Everybody, every race, every background, every religion, everybody, if they see something, they're turning it in. And I think that right there is something that people can't ignore. So if you have the woo factor, I mean, it isn't, because it's something that's out of the box thinking. But, you know, I've had people say to me, oh, please, you think that there's aliens in the world? And I kind of go back and say, oh, please, you think you're alone in the universe? Have you ever really looked at our universe? Have you ever really looked at how small our little planet is? Like, if you're small enough to think that there's nothing else there. So
exactly.
I enjoy what I do, very proud to say I do what I do. And the people that I have met in this organization, I'm intimidated by these people. These people know their stuff. They're educated people. So that is kind of a misconception. They're just like the paradigm, Scotty, with, oh, we thought you were all going to have tinfoil hats on.
Right.
You know, and then they were blown away. And the hotel staff really enjoyed it.
Yes,
so
they did.
So it's a big misconception, because every time that you have a news story, every time you have something come out on the media, they're playing the X-Files music in the background. They're laughing
right.
as they're reporting it. Therefore, instilling in the American public that it's a joke.
Well, I think that's part and parcel of the identification. And I think not to disagree with you totally, because there is a certain seriousness to what you just actually said there, Cassidy. But it also draws upon what we were talking about at the very beginning of the show, Scotty, identification, that people have this, what's this, lethargic apathy. They don't know what to align themselves with. And when you have something that comes along like MUFON, which provides a credible source of material, and as you quite rightly say, Cassie, from a whole host of educated people with their feet firmly on the ground, using people like yourselves, archivists, to put together 70,000 plus records of first-hand witness reports, one has to start looking then again, as you quite rightly say, at the media and the way in which they portray anything that is ufological, and they put a kind of spin on it. Be that the, you know, little green men, tinfoil hats, a little bit of humor and so forth. But I think that goes hand in hand with the way in which it needs to be portrayed within mass media so it can be accepted. Because if media came out and didn't sensationalize and took it as a very, very serious news item and portrayed it as such and said, you know, today over New York, Washington State, or whatever, an identified flying object was seen, it was filmed, photographed, and upteen eyewitnesses proved, and here's the footage, and it's wonderful footage, it's not blurry, it's not shaky camera. In today's age, you know, with digital cameras on every single phone, et cetera, if it wasn't taken seriously, or if there wasn't the spin on it, I think it would cause it would cause panic. Not so much a panic, but I think people would start to question, well, why is the government doing this now? Why is media doing this now? And it would plant the seed.
I think that if something came across, you know, CNN or wherever, and they said unidentified flying object was seen here and it was very serious, I think there would be a mass panic. I think people would go, oh my gosh, because people aren't thinking about it. It's sad to me that people aren't thinking about it, because I want people to think. I want people to look into history, as we spoke before. Look into what's going on. Look away from your phone, away from your computer, and take in what is around you. Nobody seems to be doing it anymore. And I think people need to.
Well said.
Well, this is something that is spoken of in some articles we were just recently talking about on the show, with the way the millennials, once again, were the focus of this, and how, politically speaking, they have moved from being an element in society, which is the new element in society, is moving away from things like ownership, which was really one of the founding cornerstones of the Constitution, was ownership. They're moving away from that and moving into more rental properties, leasing cars, all of these types of things. This thinking that is, we don't own anything anymore, but we lease it. We can get it online. We can download it. We can access it, and so on. So it's an age of access as opposed to an age of ownership. And I think this ties into what you're talking about.
It's intelligent for once. Well done.
Why? Thank you, Kansa. I think this is what you're talking about with this, is that it's a generation that needs to put down its phone. It needs to put down its tablet. It, God knows, I love my devices. I love my technology. I love my laptop, my iPad, you know, my smartphone, and all of these different things. I will probably never get an iWatch, whatever they call them, the Apple Watch. It's just too much. That's where I draw the line. John, and I have a friend of ours that has Google Glass, and he wears it around like a pair of sunglasses, and he can get on his computer when he's driving. He can get on it anywhere and access it. Yeah, it's very scary. I think this is part of the problem with the perception of UFOs, the perception of life in the universe, is perhaps some of the younger set is more open to believing it, but the access of information is different than it used to be.
How do you think the new X-Files, when it's aired, will have an impact on the credibility of such organizations as MUFON, Cassidy?
That's a cult classic, and people are very excited to bring it back. It's going to air, I think they said 6 episodes.
Yes.
And I think it's great, because I have in my office, I have the poster that says, I want to believe, you know, I have that poster. And, you know, so it's kind of ingrained in you, as I was a teenager when that was out. And I'm excited about it. I've noticed, though, which I'm happy about, but I'm confused about, ufology has seemed to become a fad lately. Somebody made a comment on Facebook the other day, a very good researcher that I know, amazing man. And he says, I turn on history and all I see is aliens. And he made a point. I mean, I love my show, but with the X-Files coming back, with these things coming back, I think the acceptance of it is getting more broad. And I think that you have certain people. The younger generation seems to be popping up now with a newfound interest in it, which I am elated about, because we do have, with ease of access, with access to information, as much as they're staring at computers, they are learning things. And there's more, you know, the communication that I can call up John when he's sitting in Egypt and go, hey, good morning, how you doing? I mean, that is an amazing thing that was not there 10 years ago. Hmm. And, you know, I can look at John, I can call you. Hey, Scotty, you want to have coffee? And we can sit and have coffee together. You're
right.
Halfway across the country. So I think that people have more of an ability to communicate with one another from all over the world, meet people. I mean, things like social media are good and bad, but they give the younger generation ways to learn about each other that we didn't have before. And so I think that more people are communicating, more people are talking. Like I said, we have 70,000 cases plus thousands of cases in the other files. People are seeing things, they're communicating with each other, they're talking, we have forums, we have websites, we have, and you know, MUFON, in my opinion, is the most credible. And it brings everybody together. So people can talk now, and I think that's a good thing. But they also need to understand that their entire life isn't in a computer. Go to a library. Take out a book, read it. Like I said earlier, when I'm researching a property, I'm researching an incident. You can't just stop with what's on a website. You can't trust what's on a website. You need to go there. You need to look at what your surroundings are. You need to go to the local people. You need to, you know, my joke was, if I needed to do historical information in the last 50 years. Go to the local bar, talk to these people. You know, what do you think about this place? And they'll tell you, but these are the local people. You need to research. You need to go into the field. A lot of people say that MUFON doesn't investigate. These are field investigators. They are on the ground. They are out doing these things. They are talking to people. They are at sites. Somebody says, I saw this. It saw this light. It landed back here. They're out there looking at things that are burned or trees that are burned. These people are out there doing it. So I think that the young individuals, you have all this access. You can learn anything you want on a computer screen, but it's only 50%. You need to go out into the world. You need to see for yourself. You need to dig through those archives, which is a pain in the butt, but it's worth it at the end. You need to unroll those old maps. You need to see where people walked before you. And I hope that this younger generation that seems to be thinking for themselves, finally, I'm hoping that they continue this and they go out and they make changes. Like John said earlier, you know, we can't sit on the fence and scream. We have to make changes.
Right.
I'm hoping that this happens. Your children, mine, John's, we're teaching our children history,
yes,
art. We're teaching all these different things. And I noticed that my son is almost an outcast at school because he'll say, well, I disagree with you on that. That's not the way it was. And he's 8.
Yes.
But I think
yes.
It's really important because
you've just hit the nail on the head there. And I'm not going to mention her name because she'll scream at me afterwards. But my darling daughter, Bryony, she thinks outside of the box. And I hope that she got that from me. And I know that's got her into trouble in the past in college and in school, mm-hmm, where she's questioned the teacher. She's questioned what she's being taught, and it's got her into trouble in some points. You're quite right, Cassidy, but I go back to the problem with the dilution of information. And does that in any way harm the credibility? That would be my question now. You answered part of the question when I asked you before about the X-Files and so forth. With you being on Hangar One and you having this kind of presence out there now, do you see a problem with the credibility of the ufological community, especially where things like MUFON and other such like experts in their field?
With Hangar One, I absolutely don't, because Hangar One is a MUFON show. The cases that are discussed on Hangar One are right out of our database. And we make an effort to, MUFON has put great effort into building landing pages for Hangar One so that if an individual is sitting on their couch, they're watching Hangar One, they see a case there, they go, wow, that's really neat. They can actually go to the Hangar One site and see the case. These are cases out of our files. These are witness submissions. With Hangar One, I'm very proud of it because I'm very proud of MUFON. They were handpicked. They were reviewed. They took a lot of effort and time to make sure that what was put out there was our witness submissions. And so I'm proud of it. I don't see that as losing credibility for MUFON. I see that as a step forward because I meet people every day that go, MUFON, what's that? And I'll say, oh, let me tell you, you know. Let me tell you about MUFON. You know, let's talk. A lot of people just don't know it's out there. So hang around.
No, I'd never heard of MUFON at all until my first Paradigm Symposium.
Really?
No, I'd never heard of him. Never heard of him.
And we're going to be back with our guest, Cassidy Nicholas. See, the pause there was so natural, I flowed right into it. I had to slow it down so it didn't just roll off my tongue. I just had to think about it for a second. And we'll be back, John Ward and me, Scotty Roberts, here on the Intrepid Radio program right after this break. Hang on.
Intrepid Radio is a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Just ask Dr. Ward. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there.
We have 15 seats available, and they are already starting to book up. So go to ExodusReality.com and get your place reserved today. That's ExodusReality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle. Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Ready for some rollicking adventure? In Scotty Roberts' book, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, join Irish Rabbit, Tam O'Hare, and his young squirrel squire, Horatio McNutt, as they journey through Scotland of the mid-1500s seeking a small child who's been stolen by the fairy folk. Crafty raccoon pirates, conniving noble wolves, conflicted royal foxes and self-serving religious badgers all stand in the way as their quest brings them headlong into high seas action and supernatural intrigue. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare is in bookstores everywhere and at barnesandnoble.com. This hardcover, lushly illustrated chapter book is the first book in the Tam O'Hare series, so swash your buckle and prepare yourself for a historically rollicking, swaggeringly supernatural adventure. Visit TamO'Hare.com to learn more. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
Sticking their fingers in the hole of the dike of humanity. Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Well, we're back with Brother John Ward. He's wearing his green. The little leprechaun is clean-shaven now. He looks like a wee laddie. Whew. Oh, Sir John. Johnny, you're gonna be picking up some clovers for us on the way.
I only talk to sensible people. Cassidy, my darling, are you still there?
Oh, I've been offhandedly brandished.
Cast aside is a good word there, brother.
We're talking about the fact that John is now clean shaven for the first time in many years. And he sent a photo over to us. I'll be sure to post this on my Facebook site. And, John, you take it away.
No, I have nothing to take away other than Cassidy.
Man.
Oh, please.
Was that Freudian?
No, I don't think it was Freudian. It was deliberate.
Got it.
Straight from the hip. Cassidy, apart from Hank One, MUFON, archaeological investigations, historical investigations. What else is it that you do that fills your time? Because, I mean, you're one of these people that you're always busy doing something. And whenever I call you or send you a quick email, send you a message, it's replied within seconds and saying, I'm on it for you now, my darling. But what else is it that makes you tick? What gets you going?
Well, I do a little bit of relic hunting. That's been my passion hobby for a long time. But that keeps me busy. Besides being a mother, you know, having a family, I have many tabs open on my computer screen all the time, whether internally or externally. I'm always somebody that I don't think I function well if I don't have a million things at once going on. And I've always been that way. As for what else I do to fill my time, I have been searching for a machine, actually in the next Intrepid magazine, I wrote a big piece for you guys on the God Machine, which is a perpetual motion machine that was built in 1853 by a man named John Murray Spear. I came in contact with this, of course, like I said before, I live in a very interesting place, so rich with history. It excites me to live here, and I'll never move because I love it. This machine was about the size of a dishwasher, very elaborate for its day, but of course, it didn't work. It was supposed to bring forth God. It was the mechanical infant of, you know, heavenly infant. And this man built this machine over a period of 9 months with a few people helping him. And I have had to trace this machine because, as history goes, as it didn't work, he preferred a loftier electronical position. So he packed the thing into two wooden crates and came to Randolph, New York, which is where we're very close to where I grew up. And then the machine, of course, was said to be trampled to the four winds by suspicious villagers. Well, I don't believe that for a second. Because
with pitchforks and torches.
Absolutely. As we all know, as we're talking about researching and doing the research on the paper trails, one thing that is well known about the 1800s newspapers, they published everything. If John Smith broke his finger in the factory, they published it. If somebody had a brawl out in the street, they published it. If somebody had a fight in a bar, they published it. Looking through history and seeing how the editorial process, what was put out, if you had a machine brought into your community that you were terrified of, don't you think they would have published it? If they trampled it, burned the buildings and trampled it, don't you think they would have published it?
Kept it secret. Did people really know he had it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The thing is that he said it was there and it was trampled by a stampede of suspicious villagers, which I think is a very interesting way to end the story of something.
Ah, very dubious story.
Yes. So, and that, when I had to pull that from Massachusetts, from something he had sent back. So he built this in Lynn, Massachusetts, on High Rock, of all places, which was known for the famed Hutchinson family, the musical family. That was very anti-slavery, women's rights, and very, very proud spiritualist. They allowed this man use of their woodshed to build this, and after a series of events, he brought it to Randolph, and that's where it disappeared. He moved on from Randolph, New York, to build the Harmonia community, which is a spiritualist community. So as I have functioned through the years, I have been tracing this machine. It has led me down a very interesting path. And I hope someday to find it. I won't go into my ideas on it because I don't want anybody else to find it.
I was going to say, have you laid hands on the machine yet?
I have not. Like I said, doing the research, doing the work, I have been to the different sites. I have walked the areas. I have pulled the properties all the way back to the Holland Land Contract, seeing what was sold, what was kept, where things were, the individuals that were around this machine that put money into it or spent time with it, what they did with their lives, where they went on to. It's been a very interesting journey. So that is my hobby, John, in my spare time, is chasing a very large machine.
Let me ask you about that machine, the theory behind it. I don't know much about it. What is it with scientists that every now and then, you hear about the God particle, you hear now about the God machine, things like this, all different kinds of things of this nature that have a spiritual quality at the core of what they're trying to get at scientifically. So did he believe, as you just mentioned very quickly at the beginning of this story, did he actually believe that this machine could conjure up God? Or was that a euphemism or just the way he was a metaphor?
Well, he was a spiritualist.
Okay.
And he was first a universalist and then went to spiritualism and was... The man was very educated. He could read. He was a minister. He was very good at public speaking. But the one thing that he wasn't good at was blueprints and the more mechanical side of things. He was said, which I hold no stock in either way, but the story goes that he would go into trance and then he would come out and build these blueprints, and they were perfect.
That's kind of cool.
And like I said, and people say, I think you're chasing a ghost. I think it never existed. But it did, because I have newspaper articles, and I have very, very educated and well-written individuals that came in contact with the machine and wrote about it, whether it was to scathe the machine or out of admiration for it. So
was the purpose of the machine, though, Cassidy?
Was brought forth. He wanted to bring through God, and they called it the heavenly infant, the electrical infant. He wanted spirits and God to be able to come through this device, and this device was built with a respiratory system, with a brain system. It was very expensive, a lot of wires, a lot of copper. At the time, it cost $2,000 to produce. And in 1853, that's a lot of money.
So it's like a 19th century spirit box, basically.
Basically. And there was a radical series of events that surrounded the, I would say, birth of the machine, including a new Mary, a woman that went into labor pains and touched the machine. I mean, the stories behind it are insanity, but they're enough to keep me interested. So he wanted to bring forth, you know, God and spirits and have this machine be able to interact. And it didn't work.
Well, sure.
I think there was an article that I have here that somebody saw it move. They had a series of metallic balls all the way around the top, and then one hit the other. And he used the excuse that he wasn't in the right electronic position. And that's why he came to Randolph, because it would surely work here in the Enchanted Mountains.
Surely.
Mm-hmm.
I even wonder with a spiritualist how you think you can, if you're dealing actually with what people presume to be the creator of the universe, you can only get him to respond to you if you have a device that somebody builds. I can actually get God to talk to me through this. Well, that sounds a little fishy to begin with.
Well, he was an interesting man.
Indeed.
He was a very bizarre individual, very intelligent, but very bizarre. And he told him that he had these, you know, he'd go into trance and he had these spirits that would come to him. He had many different ones, and the main one was the electricizers. And I believe Ben Franklin was on that board, among other people that had passed on. And these were the people that told him, through trance, to build this machine. So I went through High Rock papers, and I talked to the bar. Now it's a park. And I said, where's the woodshed? I said, we don't have a woodshed. And I said, well, where was it? And the park rangers will say, well, we don't know. So the next kind of step is to go and verify where everything was and basically follow his route here, which I've done over the years. And as bizarre as it is, the machine existed. And I don't know why I have this internal need to find it, but I do.
That's pretty cool. You know, that's better than collecting stamps.
Hey, well, it started with years ago. I had heard of the spiritualist community of Harmonia and the Cave of Harmonia. And I had read about it in a book. And I thought, wow, that's really neat. And these same spiritualists went through and under trance, they were told that they would dig into the side of this hill and find all these artifacts from an ancient Celtic web-footed race. I'm not kidding you. And these people proceeded to build this cave. And they built a whole community there, which didn't last long because, I mean, the weather here is so harsh that things break down rather quickly if they're not very sturdily built. When I read about this, I thought, well, that's really interesting. I'd like to find it. And I spent about 6 months finding it, and I finally did find the location. And I'll never share it, but I did find it, and I did contact the landowner, and I did get permission. And to feel that and to walk up on this cave, that has been sealed over in the 1930s because the thing filled up with water, of course. But to walk up to that cave and to, you know, have the fruits of your labor and to see this, that's what started it. And then to find out more about Speer and to find out all of his different exploits, what he did.
Now you found the actual cottage or the place where it was?
I found the cave.
Oh, the cave
that they the built. Cave. And that's what, but he was part of this community. After finding the cave, it set me on to finding out about the God Machine. And that's basically something that just held my interest. I don't know how you
lose
something
cool.
the size of a dishwasher, you know?
Well, where do you hope to go with that? What's the final on that one for you? Find the actual machine, put your hands. Do you think some collector has it somewhere, or it's buried in some attic somewhere, or some warehouse? What do you think?
I have many theories, but I know that history can easily be forgotten. I know that if you look hard enough and you deal with the community and you talk to the older generations and you hear the stories, eventually something will turn up, whether it was removed to this place or whether parts of it were in Jane's attic. You need to dig and dig and dig. And I don't think that it ever made it out of Randolph. I
okay.
firmly believe that the machine is still in Western New York, whether it's in pieces, whether it's buried. You know, I have some ideas this summer of 2015 that I'm excited about kind of venturing down. But I don't believe the machine ever left, whether it was destroyed or not. I don't believe the machine ever left. Whether I find it in still in the wooden crates, whether I find it as a whole, because now, the interesting thing is when it was here for approximately 3 months before it was destroyed, and it was never put back together. Destroying a machine and trampling it and ripping the heart from it, as he wrote in The New Era, I don't know how you can destroy a machine that never made it out of two crates.
Well, right.
It was never put back together. So, you know, looking through history and kind of toying with the different articles and listening to the wording, and then going to these locations myself and looking for in the field and looking at what was there before, what was there in 1854, what were the people doing. It's been a long journey, and it's rather interesting. So if I don't ever find the machine, I still have the reward of chasing it.
That's very interesting to hear about that. I love the work that you're into and the things that you get into and how unique your hobbies are. That to me shows a brain that works on a different level, looking for the God Machine. You are now on a television show that's aired a few episodes with you in the second season, Hangar One. We've mentioned it a couple of times here. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing. What's that like for you to be on television now? All of a sudden, has that, even in a smaller capacity, how has that changed things that are going on in your life? And what do you expect to get out of it?
It has changed my life in no way. Being given the invitation to go on a show that's built from the organization that I'm very proud to be part of is an achievement for me, only hoping that the best thing that I can do is to portray MUFON as it is in a serious note, portraying these people that have done thousands of hours of work. I hope that I did a good job in showing and showcasing what MUFON is and the people that belong to it. So other than the fact that I hope that I did a good thing for the organization, it has changed me in no way. Being able to talk about underwater or USOs, underwater UFOs, next to Carl Feind, who is a brilliant researcher, is an achievement for me. Being able to talk to these people and be aligned with these people that are some of the brightest minds in ufology, that is an achievement for me, a personal achievement that I have done that I'm very proud of. As for hoping where I go with this, I have no long-term goal with that. The only goal that I have is to continue working for MUFON and to do everything that I can to help my organization. I'm proud of who I am aligned next to. The SIs and the chief field investigators that are on that show are amazing people. They are people that have put the work in. They are people that have read and done and went. They're doers, and I'm very proud to be even aligned with them. As for the future, I plan on working the cases with MUFON. I always make comments on social media, the little blue screen, because the CMS screen is blue, and that's all I look at. And I like it. I enjoy it. I'm very proud of it. As for the TV, to me, is not something that directly affects my life. MUFON is. As for where I hope I go with it, wherever it goes.
Well, fantastic. I'm glad you got that gig, too. I'm happy for you on that.
I didn't really know how to take it when I was first asked. I thought, well, oh, boy.
I remember that. I remember
yeah, I did. I think
some
I called
phone calls.
Said, what do I do with this? What do I do with this? It's a positive because it's something that I believe in, and it's an organization that I love very much.
That's fantastic. John, were you going to chime in with something there?
I was just going to say that's so humbling. And I've said this before to Cass as well. I've said it to her face, and I don't mind saying it on air to the audience. When you see Cassie and you speak to her in person, she is a very humbling person. And you can hear the passion, you see the passion in her when you speak to her face-to-face. And if anybody needs a break and get in TV like you have, Cassidy, it's you. You do have a passion, you do have a drive, you do have an enthusiasm. Your research is impeccable, and I know because we've discussed it so many times. And I just wish there were more people like you out there who have that drive and that passion and that enthusiasm, but goes beyond that and has that meticulous eye for detail. So much so, there's so many researchers out there say, oh, I'm a researcher, an investigator. They, all the, as you said, Google is their investigation tool. And that's as far as they go. You take it to the very limits. You're there in the field. You're there, hands in the mud, so to speak. It's wonderful. And I'm honored to call you a friend.
Well, thank you, John.
Damn straight, John. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Cass, where can people find you, find out more about what you're doing? Where can they see you on TV?
They can see me every Friday night at 10 p.m. I'm not on all of the episodes. I only discuss certain cases. So I basically float within, you know, in and out of the season for different cases that I discussed.
That's 10 p.m. Eastern, right?
Time, yep. History, and it is MUFON's very own Hangar 1. I attend a lot of the MUFON conferences. That's basically where you'll find me. I do have a public Facebook page that you can find under Cassidy Nicholas. I put a lot of articles up, different things, and that's where I spend a lot of the time is there. I'm in the process of building a website now that will cover everything from, as we discussed, relic hunting to history to ufology to more of the higher-end experiments within supernatural experiments and things and different social experiments we'll cover. That will be up and live, and that will be the obscure case book, but that is still being built as we speak. I'm there. I'm just the background.
That's fantastic. Well, congratulations to you on that. Cass, it's been fantastic talking to you tonight. Believe it or not, we're at the end of this program in about a minute and a half.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to meet Cassidy face-to-face, then go to ParadigmSymposium.com.
Absolutely.
And buy your tickets now.
And they should. I know we have a minute left, but anybody who's interested in any of the out-of-the-box thinking and they want to meet legitimate thinkers, educated people, and become part of our family, really take the time to plan, take the time to go to Paradigm. It is a wonderful, it's the best event.
Well, amen to that. We have a special for MUFON members. Go to our website, ParadigmSymposium.com, and check it out. Come to meet Cassidy Nicholas. I almost did it again. Man, whew. Maybe the pause just seems too great for me, and the gap, people aren't here yet. I don't know. So, Cassidy, again, thanks for being with us. John, guess what? We're literally at the end of the show. We got like 20 seconds left. Folks, join John and I and Rocky on Thursday for the Situation Room at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. And until next week, John, say goodnight.
Good night.
Inside the mountain, I see fire. Burning the trees, and I see fire. Hollow in soul, I see fire. Blood in the breeze, and I hope that you.